Blog Talk Radio. To research at the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join this show every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Central, where Bernice Alexander Bennett will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share their resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of the guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions of tonight's guest. A few months ago, you may recall the guest Joanne Abel discussing the Jeans teachers and their community organizing work to build the Rosenwald schools. Tonight's show focuses on another occupation prominent and African-American communities, funeral directors. Dr. Suzanne E. Smith is professor of history in the Department of History and Art History at George Mason University. Her first book, Dancing in the Street, Motown and the Cultural Politics of Detroit, published in 2000, examines Motown and its relationship to the Black community of Detroit and the Civil Rights Movement. It was awarded third in the 11th annual Gleason Music Book Awards, sponsored by NYU, Rolling Stone, and BMI. Her latest book, To Serve the Living, Funeral Directors and the African American Way of Death, published in 2010, explores the role of funeral directors and African-American life and their participation in the National Civil Rights Movement. To Serve the Living was a finalist for the Library of Virginia's Nonfiction Literary Award in 2011. Her current book project is a biography of the African-American radio evangelist Elder Lightfoot Solomon Meshaw. Let me give a warm welcome to Dr. Smith to research at the National Archives and Beyond. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for being a guest. Dr. Smith, how did you become interested in the subject of African-American funeral directors?
Interestingly enough, it came out of my work on Motown in Detroit. I was studying the Black community in Detroit in that project and trying to understand who the community leaders were, and so many of the community leaders in Detroit were funeral directors, such as Charles Diggs. And when I was coming across some of the research on Charles Diggs and his House of Diggs funeral home, I saw one of the advertisements, and it said, "Nobody serves the living like Diggs." And when I saw that advertisement, I thought, wow, I wonder how these funeral directors actually did serve the living. And it really got me thinking about that whole dimension of the profession and how important it was to the Black community, not just burying the dead, but what the funeral directors meant to the Black community.
And I think you've already addressed my next question, which was, how did you come up with your title to serve the living? So thank
yeah.
you for explaining that. Before exploring the unique role funeral directors played in African-American life, let's first discuss death in funerals during slavery. Death, in a sense, had a double meaning to the enslaved population. Would you explain?
Yes, it was really fascinating to me when I began the research on the slave period, and I really had to dig deep into the cosmology of death that started in West Africa, the West African traditions that were brought across during the transatlantic slave trade. And the idea among in West African tradition, too, that the world of the living and the world of the dead were very intimately connected with each other. And many of your listeners would know that just the honoring of the ancestors that is a part of African culture in general. But it became even more powerful during the transatlantic slave trade when Africans were enslaved and brought to the New World. That's where I trace in the book this idea of a homegoing. The idea of calling a death a homegoing actually came out of the slave trade when some African slaves who died on the Middle Passage, it was believed that their spirits would go home, literally homegoing. Later it had a more Christian concept of going home to God, but the idea of a homegoing kind of started in slavery. Once the enslaved were brought to the New World, death, like I said, always had this kind of mystical connection to freedom, that you, when you died, it was something almost to be celebrated because your spirit was going to be free and you were going to be finally free of the oppression of enslavement. So that's part of, like I said, what I start to talk about at the beginning of the book, the powerful connection in African-American life between the concept of death, but also the concept of death as freedom, spiritual or just physical freedom.
That's amazing to think that the home going goes back that far. And before we talk further about your book, did you see a recent PBS special on home goings?
Yes. It was a point of view documentary that was just on, 2 weeks ago, I believe. I did have some connection with the project and helped them to promote it. I thought it was a very wonderful, personal, intimate view of an African-American funeral director from New York, and this idea of the powerful cultural meanings that funerals have within Black communities that have many, many layers.
So were you part of the production at all, or did you have any affiliation with
The producers of the film eventually contacted me after they had finished the film because the person who was featured in the film, it was kind of a very personal story of just his career. But the producers of the film got in touch with me as they were finishing production. They wanted me to kind of endorse the film, and they had, if the listeners go to the website about the film, they relied a lot on my historical research for the historical references in the film. And one of the things I did notice in the film, in some of the historic images that they show are directly from my book. They showed a couple images of the Morris Ford lynching funeral and things that I actually discuss in my book. So I was very honored that they kind of used my research in that way to give historical context to the picture of this man's career as a funeral director.
That is an honor, isn't it, for them to find your book and then actually use it as a basis for some of the presentation in the film.
Well, yeah.
Very nice recognition. Returning to your book, can you explain what were the cultural origins of an intense interest in a proper burial?
I would say it would go back to what I started to talk about a few moments ago, that in West African traditions that were brought over to the New World, there was a lot of importance laid on a proper burial in the sense that there was a belief that you had to bury a person with a certain set of rituals to ensure that their spirit would move on to the afterlife or the next spiritual world freely, that you wouldn't, you know, if you didn't bury someone properly, then you might, you know, have a spirit that kept haunting the earth, right? That you wanted to make sure their spirit was released into the next world. So in West African tradition, which again became a part of African American tradition, one of the things I talk about in the book is grave decoration, right? That there was this idea that when you buried someone, you decorated the grave in a particular way, and the way you decorated the grave would help the spirit of the deceased be released from the earthly realm. And as I discuss in the book, in West African beliefs about death, there was a belief which I thought was quite beautiful, right, that the world of the living and the world of the dead are interconnected, but they're separated. In African traditions, it's often believed that the separation is the ocean, like a water separates the world of the living from the world of the dead. And that there's a belief that if you look at the ocean and you see, like, sunlight dancing on waves, that is, in African tradition, often the belief that's the spirit of dead people, you know, a signal that they are there. And in grave decoration, it is very interesting. They would often involve either decorating the grave with objects that the deceased touched just before they died, objects that were very important to the deceased person that would decorate the grave. But interestingly enough, they would also decorate the grave with things that would hold water. So it could be broken crockery, it could be pitchers. Later on in African American tradition, they often decorated the grave with mirrors, things that would simulate water. So this idea that if you decorated a grave in a particular way, that helped the spirit of the dead person move on to the next realm of the spiritual world. And that was how you made sure, like I said, that their spirit was at peace after death.
Wow, it's interesting, the origin. Sometimes I don't think we think about why we do things the way we do today, and you provide that historical context.
Yes.
In your book, you mention hush harbors. What
yes.
were those?
The hush harbors are often, they're either called hush harbors or brush harbors, were usually wooded areas near the behind slave quarters on plantations. And one of the most important arguments I think I make in the book about the slave period is that that the slave funeral, which is often held very late at night after all work was done on the plantation, was really, what I argue in the book, was the foundation of the African-American independent church, right? That it was slave funerals where you first see African-Americans allowed to have religious services to themselves. They're able to preach to themselves. And it was happening in, like I said, these hush harbors in wooded areas late at night, usually after midnight. And they would have, at least for a while in the early colonial period, it was a space where African-American enslaved people could have, like I said, a very independent religious spiritual experience, and they were not under the observation of the white master. Now that changes around 1800 when there's the Gabriel's Rebellion in Virginia, one of the first major slave rebellions in Virginia. It was discovered that Gabriel, the slave who led the rebellion, actually organized his plans at the funeral of a slave, an infant. And after that, the white plantation owners became very nervous about African Americans having their own slave funerals without anybody watching over them. So it became something that got much more monitored. They often required after that a white person had to be present at a funeral service. So it was a real symbol of how there was, like I said, this historic period where you could see a lot of independence on the part of blacks in terms of having religious experiences to themselves, and then it got more monitored after that. But that was the significance of the hush harbors, is that I really believe, like, the funeral was, like I said, this place where you first see the emergence of what they called slave preachers or ministers, African Americans who could actually preach sermons to themselves about their own experience, not be preached to by a white clergy person.
I know you mentioned Nat Turner's rebellion in the book. As far as you know, was that planned at a funeral?
I've done a good bit of research on Nat Turner's rebellion, and I teach it in my classes at George Mason. There's no evidence that he planned anything at a funeral, but because of Gabriel's rebellion, there were a lot of rumors that went kind of rampant after the rebellion happened in Virginia and the Commonwealth. And what you really notice, historians notice, is soon after Nat Turner's rebellion, again, there was more restrictions put on how slaves could bury their own. And so there was, you definitely have evidence that people thought that that could have happened, but there was never direct evidence, and I don't think in any of the documentation of the trial or whatever that he actually planned anything at a funeral, although it could have happened, I suppose.
Let's shift forward a little bit in time. How did funerals change in American society due to the Civil War?
Well, the Civil War was such a dramatic change because it was a time in which 600,000 people died during the war itself, and it was such a massive loss of life that all Americans at that time in the mid-19th century had to adjust their understanding of death in very profound ways. And Drew Gilpin Faust, a professor at Harvard, she wrote the book This Republic of Suffering. Some of your listeners might have heard of it or might be interested in it, which is a whole book just about how all this massive death in the Civil War period changed Americans' relationship to death. But what I talk about in my book is really what really comes out of the Civil War was because there were so many soldiers who died on the field in battle, there was this idea that you had to embalm the remains of the deceased. And this was primarily for Union soldiers, as you might imagine, who were killed in battle on Confederate soil. There was a lot of Northern families who wanted their loved ones to be transported back to the North for a proper burial and a funeral back in the North. So embalming, which up until the Civil War had been mainly only used in medical research, there was the only time people were embalmed was to preserve a body so medical students could learn from it. During the Civil War, there was a massive change where all these soldiers were embalmed and then shipped back to their families in the North, and people in American society realized that embalming was an important way to facilitate the grieving process, that if you could preserve the body a little bit longer, it allowed more people to be able to see the body before it was buried and process their grief. This transition happened, like I said, throughout the Civil War and all these different battles where people began to use embalming a lot more. And this is where the funeral industry is really born, because we had embalmers, trained embalmers, who started to go to all the different battlefields offering their services. But what was also significant was when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, he was embalmed, and his body was transported from Washington all the way to Springfield, Illinois, over the course of, I believe it was about 2 weeks. And the train went all over the United States, and Americans got to see his body. And it was, like I said, the first time I think collectively Americans thought, wow, this is a real way to allow people to grieve, process grief in a new way. So embalming becomes popularized and from that point on as kind of an American tradition. And I think, you know, it's very unique as if you study world customs around the world for death. Americans are unique in their, their interest or their support of embalming. A lot of other cultures around the world don't think embalming is necessary or scorn it even. But in American society, because of the Civil War, it becomes a standard method of preserving the dead to process grief.
Let's move a little bit forward in time again. The post-Civil War era, about the 1880s, why were mutual aid societies, secret societies, and burial leagues important in African American communities?
They become very important because it's in the Reconstruction post-war Civil War period that the funeral industry, as I just mentioned, starts to emerge as an industry. And the other industry that emerges in this period is the insurance industry. The life insurance, you know, it comes out of this period. You see a lot of consolidation in corporations in this point, in American society. And in the insurance business, they actually come out in the 1880s, 1890s, with some studies saying that African Americans are too high a risk, particularly around life insurance and burial insurance. And they bring out these studies that were quite racist, actually, saying, you know, you shouldn't insure black people. Now, African-American communities responded with these mutual aid societies, their own secret societies, and their own burial leagues, primarily, to connect what we were talking about a few moments ago, to ensure that African-Americans would get a proper burial. And that each, you would join one of these either secret societies or burial leagues, and you'd you'd contribute a certain amount of money every week, and it would go into the central fund, and it was a way to ensure that you and your family members would have the homegoing ceremony that you wanted at the time of death. And what I argue in the book, which is really significant, is that this really is the foundation of the African-American funeral industry, that the African-American communities responded so quickly to the discrimination they faced from the insurance industry that they were able to really construct the capital, the foundation, the money to help African-American funeral directors have, you know, a consumer base and be able to start these businesses.
I want to get back a little bit to embalming. I'm assuming this was considered a trade, a skill. How did African Americans, or whom did some African Americans learn from so they could also provide this service to the black community?
That's a great question. I was going to mention when I was talking about the Civil War that the earliest evidence we have of an African American embalmer is a man by the name of Prince Greer, who was actually a slave of one of the Confederate soldiers, and he was actually traveling with some other embalmers who trained him on how to embalm. So what was interesting, actually, is even during the Civil War, there was a few documented African-Americans who actually were in that early period of the Civil War kind of on the battlefield learning the embalming trade. One of the most fascinating things I discovered when I was doing this research is that when embalming schools start to get founded in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century, they were integrated. They welcomed African-American students. And some of the most prestigious embalming schools, there was one in New York. When I visited some African-American funeral homes that were over 100 years old, they had, you know, what would you call, like, graduation photographs of the class that their great-grandfather or whatever had graduated from embalming school. And you would see this sea of white faces and maybe three or four African-Americans in the embalming school. So it was quite interesting to me that in the early formation of the funeral industry, African-Americans were actually enrolled in embalming school just like anyone else, and that's where they were trained. It really wasn't until, I would say, the 1930s and 40s that you see more segregated. There's an African-American embalming school that's founded in Georgia, if I'm recalling correctly, in Atlanta. And then you see a couple embalming schools that are kind of created for African-Americans primarily. But it was one of the more fascinating discoveries, I think, of my research that, you know, considering that this was the height of Jim Crow, and I talk a lot about that the formation of the funeral industry parallels the formation of Jim Crow segregation after the Civil War, that there was this space in embalming training where African Americans were actually integrated right into the most prestigious academies for embalming that whites would go to.
Talking about the Jim Crow era, What was unique about Black funeral directors in the segregated South?
What was unique about them is that as Jim Crow is, like you said, really coming into strength, you know, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, all these laws are getting passed, separation of races, and the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896, which was the Supreme Court decision saying separate but equal is okay. As I talk about in the book, even in the Plessy case, you have there's a committee of elite African Americans in New Orleans who are fighting. They're a part of that case. They're trying to, like I said, dismantle Jim Crow segregation in Louisiana, and there's prominent funeral directors who are involved. And in the Deep South, what you see is this interesting, what I talk about in the book, an interesting kind of contradiction. Like the African-American funeral directors are actually benefiting in some way from Jim Crow segregation in the sense that they have a more clear-cut market of African-American consumers at that time, but they're also fighting Jim Crow because they see the injustice of it, and they know that if they eventually dismantled Jim Crow, that it would actually complicate their ability to have their businesses succeed. So you see that in a lot of different ways, and there's many different examples I can offer in the book. Another one I'm thinking of is Preston Taylor, who is a very famous funeral director in Nashville. And he was incredible. He actually started as a minister, and he was an incredible leader in Nashville. He goes into the funeral business as very, very successful, makes a lot of money, and he's able through his wealth to not only create a beautiful, you know, leisure park for elite and middle class African Americans in Nashville, Greenwood Park. He also creates a cemetery for African Americans in Nashville. And then when Nashville starts to pass laws against segregating the races on streetcars, he decides he's going to open his own streetcar business and make sure that African Americans have a dignified way to get to work. So he is, like, to me, this best example of what I'm trying to explain. Like, he responds to Jim Crow with his money and his power, and he says, okay, if you're going to say separate but equal, then I'm going to create these spaces, streetcars and leisure parks for African Americans in Nashville so they always feel that they can live their lives with dignity. The white community in Nashville tries to fight back against him by, you know, trying to close down his leisure park and trying to fight back against his streetcar company. But to me, he's this incredible example of what you were asking me of, like this funeral director who's able to use his economic power and his strength as a community leader to really fight against Jim Crow.
And through his life and what he was doing, he obviously exemplifies what you're referring to about serving the living, not just
absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, he's one of the, I always love talking about Preston Taylor because he's just such a hero to me, and I think he's still a hero in Nashville. I think there's buildings named after him to this day, you know, that he had a real vision, and he knew, like I said, the power of his role as a community leader to create, like I said, places for Africa. He felt strongly, I think, that African Americans should have dignity in the midst of this Jim Crow discrimination.
And he obviously was able to build wealth from being a funeral director, but then he gave back to the community.
Yeah, and that's why he was such a hero. I mean, he was so revered in the Nashville community because of what he did. Yeah.
Well, let's take a break right now. We'll take a 1-minute break, and then we'll continue with this discussion.
Great.
research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp, and you are listening to Dr. Suzanne E. Smith, Professor of History in the Department of History and Art History at George Mason University. I want to remind everyone that all of these shows are archived and available immediately after the broadcast as a podcast. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please dial 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. Dr. Smith, let's continue discussing these funeral directors who serve the living. I believe in your book you discuss Charles C. Diggs Sr., who was a leading black funeral director in Detroit. He's mm-hmm. another one who exemplified this. Would you please discuss the Detroit Memorial Park?
Yes. Charles C. Diggs Sr., was one of the founding funeral directors in the funeral industry in Detroit, as he was the father of Charles Diggs Jr., who became the famous congressman in the middle of the 20th century. And he was another example of these incredible leaders of these local communities who had a vision for what they were going to do to help the community. And Charles Diggs Sr. was also, he was one of the first African Americans elected to the Michigan State Legislature. And when he went into the state legislature, he was very active, again, in trying to pass civil rights laws in Michigan to support African Americans. But beyond that, he founded the Detroit Memorial Park, which was one of the first African American cemeteries in the Detroit area. And he does this in the early 20th century, in the 1920s, and he gets a group of African American funeral directors together, and they decide to found this cemetery, because there was a lot of discrimination in cemeteries at this time. If African Americans were allowed to be buried in a white cemetery, it was usually in the worst section of the white cemetery, or they were treated with disrespect when they came to have their funerals. They had to come in through a back entrance to the cemetery. And Charles Diggs was responding to this. He wanted to have a cemetery where African Americans could have a proper funeral and, again, be treated with respect. So he organizes a bunch of funeral directors in Detroit to found this memorial park, as it was called at the time, because it had the grave markers that were flushed to the ground, which was the memorial park style. And what fascinated me about this story is that they found this cemetery and they placed it in Warren, Michigan, which, if any of your listeners know, which is a suburb of Detroit that has historically been very white and not welcoming of African Americans. Well, they get the land, they start to plan the cemetery, and the community at that point isn't going to resist it until they find out that there's an African American person who's going to live on the land as the caretaker of the cemetery. And then there's this resistance from the Warren community. They try to stop the sale of the land. The funeral directors decide to quickly bury a stillborn infant on the property to ensure that it would be a cemetery. And they, again, like I said, battle a little bit to get this land. They get the land, and then they have this incredible success of having this funeral, co-op create this cemetery. Well, then the Depression hits in the 1930s. There's a lot of financial crises, and it looks like at some point the cemetery is not going to quite make it, but they actually hold together. They make it as a solid financial institution, and the Detroit Memorial Park becomes so viable, economically viable, they're able to give loans, home loans, to local African-American families so that they can purchase a home in the Detroit area. And so many white banks were refusing blacks who wanted home loans. That it was, again, one of these marvelous examples of, again, the funeral directors serving the living, that they created a cemetery that ended up being like a type of, loan institution for local African Americans who were desperate to buy a home. And I love, again, that connection with this death giving life to those around the community.
Wow. I mean, obviously he was very successful to be able to issue loans for individuals seeking to buy property.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing.
We've discussed two individuals, Preston Taylor and Charles C. Diggs Sr., as examples of funeral directors who really served a living. And let's say the activities were very positive. But I believe you profile in your book some additional African-American funeral directors, maybe more up north in urban environments, where their activity wasn't quite on the up and up.
Well, it's interesting because what you find is, I talk about this in detail, is that on the surface it seems that things, some shady business is going on. And the best example, of course, is in Chicago. There's Dan Jackson, who is one of the most famous funeral directors in Chicago in the early 20th century. And he runs, again, like a very prominent Jackson funeral home in Chicago. But he also is moving in what they would call the underworld economy. He uses some of his funeral homes as gambling houses in off hours, and he gets involved in a lot of different activities, like I said, around, particularly in Prohibition. There's a lot of funeral homes, in African-American funeral homes in the 1920s and early 30s that have under after-hours drinking. You know, they create these little clubs that are inside the funeral homes. And back to your question, like, it seems kind of shady what they're doing. In the case of Dan Jackson, I talk in the book about how he actually sort of redefines respectability at that point, because he was very, very highly regarded in the Chicago South Side, because he was always there helping people in need, people who were poor. He would often be the person, throughout the country, African-American funeral directors were often the person that you would turn to if you needed to get bailed out of jail. They would often have bail money. And Dan Jackson was known for that, that he was charitable, that he helped people in crisis, that he would bail you out if you got arrested. And so he was also, he was known for kind of having these connections to gambling and such. But he was also respected because he was able to help people in need, and he was very politically savvy, and he was very well connected with the white power structure in Chicago and the mayor's office, and he ultimately helps Oscar DePriest get elected to Congress, the first African-American elected to Congress in the 20th century. And one of the stories I tell in the book, which I think is so fascinating, is that while he's helping Oscar DePriest get elected, he's also being investigated for voter fraud. And he actually gets in trouble because he had given a lot of people the address of his funeral home to register to vote, and he gets accused of voter fraud. And he, it seems like, you know, a crisis that most people would not be able to survive, but he actually survives it, and Oscar DePriest gets elected. And like I said, what I'd like to talk about with people interested in this part of the story is that nothing's as clear, nothing's black and white in this world. You know, at this point in American history, these funeral directors were using everything in their power and often being very shrewd, sometimes on the boundaries of legal and illegal activities. But in most cases, they were trying to navigate, like you said, and help their communities get empowered in some way or help people in need. And so there were, like I said, on the surface, you might say, oh, that person was doing something that was really, like, shady. But in the, within the community, it was seen in a different way because of the way people saw the grand picture of what was going on.
In your book, you note the emergence of the funeral home was the most significant development in the modern funeral industry in the 1920s. Why was this development particularly important to segregated African-American communities?
Well, that's kind of connected to actually what we were just talking about, because what I found most fascinating is, but well, before the 1920s, there really weren't funeral homes in any broad sense, embalmers tended to come to your house and embalm your loved one in your house, and then they would be laid out in the parlor of your house, and that would be where a visitation would happen. It's not until the 1920s that the funeral industry comes up with this idea of a funeral home and understands that this is a way to really market themselves to a skeptical public. The funeral industry as a whole was getting questioned about whether it was a legitimate profession or if they were just trying to take people for their money at a moment of grief. And the funeral home really creates a lot of respectability for the profession of funeral directing. In African-American communities, what's really significant to me was that it created a space, a public space where African-Americans could meet when they were often denied that access to public spaces because of Jim Crow segregation. And the only other dominant public space where you could meet was often in a black church, but black churches often restricted what kind of activities could happen there, of course. Like, you couldn't have, some churches wouldn't allow dancing or any alcohol. What you have at the funeral home is a place where these funeral directors, they create these really nice palatial funeral homes, and they open them to the black community as a social meeting place. And it's a great marketing skill. They can, say, open up their communities in ways that allow African Americans to have another place to go to for social gatherings, for secret society meetings. A.D. Price is one of the funeral homes I talk about in Richmond, Virginia, which he created. It was like a funeral home that had three stories, and at least the top two stories of the funeral home were completely used as rental space for social gatherings. It was only the first floor of the funeral home that was used for the actual embalming and visitation for a funeral. And another great example I have is a funeral director in Nashville, again, A.N. Johnson. He actually advertised when he created his funeral home that his funeral home had a ladies' waiting area or waiting room, and in his advertisements for the funeral home he said, women, African-American, or at the time they would say colored women or African-American women, can come to my ladies' waiting room after they've been treated curtly in the local stores, right? That he was, like, directly addressing Jim Crow segregation and, the disrespect that particularly African-American women might feel when they went into a department store. And he basically advertised in the Nashville newspaper, come to my funeral home after you might have been treated rudely, and I will treat you with respect. And the funeral home was what I would call like a safe haven for African Americans to socialize.
It shows that these black funeral directors were truly entrepreneurs. They had the space, and they found ways to not only open their doors to the community, but also make some money.
Yeah, I mean, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. I would have to say I've actually spoken at a lot of funeral director conventions since the book was published. And when I tell some of these stories, some of the funeral directors say, "Wow, that's really a great marketing idea." Like, they don't, you know, they forget that there was this other, you know, ways people really created, as you would say today, like brand loyalty, right? Like, these African American funeral directors were kind of visionaries for how to create real loyalty in their communities to their businesses.
A surprising revelation in your book, at least to me, was the role a funeral director played in the early career of Mahalia Jackson. Would you please share how Robert H. Miller, who was a co-owner of Miller and Major Funeral Home in Chicago, became involved with this famous singer?
Yes, it's one of my favorite stories in the book, is that Robert Miller, who was one of the big leaders in the African-American funeral industry once they had their own professional associations, Mahalia Jackson, you know, she migrates north to Chicago, and she's from the Deep South. And when she gets to Chicago, she starts her career singing in her church, of course, but eventually she, you know, starts to be heard around the area of Chicago. And Robert Miller is one of the first people that hears her, and he hires her to sing at funerals. Now, for, you know, anyone who's interested in the history of gospel blues, which I kind of know a good bit about, like, gospel blues is forming at this time, this idea of the gospel blues, and it was among black elites, it was kind of looked down upon sometimes, the gospel blues sound. Robert Miller really saw Mahalia Jackson's talent. He took her to these funerals, and she became this big draw again for his funeral home, because he would say, if you have a funeral with me, Mahalia Jackson will sing at your funeral. Well, then he decides to kind of become her manager, and he creates her early career. She signs him on as a manager, and he drives her around in his hearse, and then he is actually facilitates the first recordings that she does. And she actually, because of her familiarity with the funeral business, which I thought was interesting, she was very much an entrepreneur herself, and she opened her own florist business because she saw all the flowers that were being bought for these funerals, and she would often tell people, if you buy my flowers, I'll sing at your loved one's funeral. And they just had this incredible relationship, Robert Miller and Mahalia Jackson.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, they did. And she spoke of him fondly, even in her memoir later in life. She said, you know, again, when she first moved to Chicago, she felt the scorn of a lot of black elites in the city who looked down on the gospel blues. But she said, Robert Miller was always in my corner, basically, always believing in me. Now, what else I talk about in the book is that funeral directors, again, because of their capital, their money that many of them accumulated, I saw them as a real backbone of the rise of the modern gospel music industry. And what I mean by that is that many black funeral directors sponsored radio programs. They would either sponsor a gospel radio program on the air. Many of them owned radio stations. Black radio stations were connected to funeral homes. And you see the way in which the funeral business actively supported the gospel music industry, either through radio programming or by owning radio stations.
Who would have ever realized that these funeral directors were so diverse in their business activities?
Yes, yes. They had many irons in the fire, as we'd say.
Well, let's shift a little bit forward in time to the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, where the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional racial segregation in public education. I think, as most people know, the modern civil rights movement gained momentum with this decision. How was the civil rights movement both threatening and inspiring to black funeral directors?
It was threatening in the sense, as I mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation, that throughout the 20th century, African-American funeral directors were always fighting to secure their market of customers. And I think the one thing I talk about in the book is there was always this kind of assumption that black funeral directors always had the black customer in their corner. But that wasn't the case. In fact, white funeral directors often tried to get black customers because they just needed the business. Once the funeral industry kind of became very popular or grew a lot, there was a lot of competing funeral directors. In any case, there was a sense when the civil rights movement really takes off in the mid-1950s that if you completely ended segregation, it would make it even more challenging for the black funeral director because there would be the competition would increase with white funeral homes. But the real story I found that was powerful was that these black funeral directors were, again, the backbone of the civil rights movement, both in the way they funded the movement behind the scenes, the way they were involved bailing out civil rights activists who got arrested, the ways in which they protected civil rights activists like Martin Luther King. They were often the security detail for civil rights activists who were being threatened with, you know, their lives were being threatened. There's a story in the book I tell of James Farmer's life being saved by a funeral director who hid him in a hearse and raced him away from a situation that could have turned into a lynching. So it was a very complicated time because, like, again, these funeral directors wanted to support the movement, even though they knew in the long run it might affect them economically in a dramatic way.
Well, speaking of funeral directors sort of trying to find their place with the movement going on with the modern civil rights movement, In your book, you discuss the Emmett Till case and his mother's decision to have, I believe, the casket open.
Yes.
And would you discuss that and what was important or significant about that whole process and some of the black funeral directors that may have been involved?
What was significant about that, as most people are aware, of course, is that her decision was to leave the casket open so the world could see what they had done to my boy, as she said. And it was such a dramatic event in American history. But what I talk about in the book is that it really also, there was a lot going on behind the scenes with the funeral directors who made that happen. When Emmett Till's body was discovered in the Tallahatchie River and taken out of the river, the sheriff in Mississippi, Sheriff Strider, called a black funeral director, Chester Miller, to come get the body, and they were actually trying to... The sheriff asked Chester Miller to take the body out of the river and bury it immediately in Mississippi. He wanted all the evidence to be buried. Chester Miller started to do as he was told when Till's family intervened and said, we want him buried in Chicago. So as soon as they decided they weren't going to have him buried in Mississippi, Chester Miller actually said, I can't be involved anymore because my life will be at risk. So Emmett Till's body was then given over to a white funeral director in Mississippi who prepared the body for shipment to Chicago. The story that some people have is that he was actually, they put lye on the remains of Emmett Till so he would decompose even more. He was then shipped to Chicago to the Rainer Funeral Home in Chicago. That's when Mamie Till Bradley insisted that they open the casket or the box that he had come in, even though they had said they wouldn't, and that's when she saw his body and made that big decision. The other thing I discuss in the book is that she eventually, in the trial in September of 1955, the sheriff comes to testify, and he says the big pivot was saying that they didn't know if Emmett Till's body, when Emmett Till was pulled out of the river, if he was black or white. It was hard to, you know, maybe it was all staged. He was trying to create this doubt about whether the body was even Emmett Till's. And Mamie Till Bradley eventually goes and speaks out about this, and she says, you know, that when they pulled the body out of the river, they called a black undertaker. That's the evidence that they knew it was Emmett Till. They knew it was a black young man because they never would have called a black undertaker to deal with a white body in Mississippi. So there's a lot of things I discuss in the book about that, but in the end, the most important thing that comes out of the Emmett Till case is this idea that civil rights activists in the mid-50s really get attached to this idea that the funerals of the slain martyrs of the movement can be political theater, that this can be a way to galvanize the country around the cause. And Mamie Till Bradley, I really attribute that to her. Like, she had a vision about what the tragic death of her son meant. And from then on, you see a lot of drama that plays out around the deaths of significant people in the movement, whether you're talking about Medgar Evers or James Chaney in the Mississippi Freedom Summer. And it's also the Malcolm X funeral in 1965, which is a very contentious funeral.
Please describe that more.
The Malcolm X funeral?
Yes.
The Malcolm X funeral was contentious because of the nature of his assassination and the fact that the funeral home, the Unity Funeral Home in Harlem, was actually receiving all kinds of bomb threats that... Malcolm X's enemies said they were going to come and try to bomb the funeral home that he was in. And there was this large police presence that was on the roof of the funeral home protecting people who came to the visitation for Malcolm X. And then when they finally had the funeral, as I write about in the book, it was probably the most heavily policed funeral in the history of New York. I mean, they had hundreds and hundreds of police officers at Malcolm X's funeral, and then they actually, when they went to bury him at the cemetery, a fight almost broke out because they had these white unionized cemetery workers who were supposed to put Malcolm X's remains in the ground. His followers said, no white man is going to put Malcolm X into the ground. and a kind of fight broke out at the gravesite, and his followers kind of won the battle, and they lowered him into the ground and buried him. But I see in that particular story, it's kind of intra-racial tension around the funeral of Malcolm X, which is, you know, another chapter of this story of what funerals can mean in African-American communities.
And I'm not sure if you can really elaborate on this, but how did these funeral directors feel? Were they concerned as you have more of these funerals that were sort of politicized in a way because of what was going on with the civil rights movement? Was there tension among the funeral directors of should they be that aggressive or should they really be just in the shadows?
That's a great question. I would say there was definitely a tension, and there was definitely some people who didn't want to get involved at all. And there was definitely people who just insisted they wanted to be involved, but they always wanted it to be behind the scenes. A.G. Gaston, who is one of the most famous funeral directors that I talk about in the book, and he, in Birmingham, Alabama, he was a very successful, one of the most successful entrepreneurs of African-American history in the 20th century. But, you know, he worked behind the scenes a lot, supporting the movement, while also kind of placating whites on the surface. And people often accused him of being too conservative, that he was too, you know, accommodating to whites. When I dug more deeply into his career, I saw him more in an almost radical vein, because the best example I have of he had in the early, 40s and 50s, he had so much money that he was able to threaten car dealers who were, like, selling him the hearses that he would use on all his different funeral homes. And he said, he went to this one car dealer and he said, if you don't integrate your sales force, I'm going to not buy cars from you anymore. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, all these car dealerships in Birmingham got hired African Americans in response to A.G. Gaston's threat. So I see him as an example of the tension that they were trying to, succeed, but they also were able to use their power again to fight in ways that people didn't always pick up at the time. And like I said, he ultimately, the threat is back to what you're saying, like a lot of the African-American funeral directors were, especially in the Deep South, were very nervous about being too associated with the civil rights movement because they would face bomb threats themselves or death threats, and many of them did.
So they had to make a decision, and sometimes their livelihood and maybe even their lives were in jeopardy.
Yeah, A.G. Gaston's house was bombed, his mansion. He had this huge mansion in Birmingham, and he was very involved in the Birmingham campaign in 1964 because he allowed, 63, excuse me, he allowed Martin Luther King and his followers to stay at the Gaston Motel in Birmingham, and the motel was bombed, and then within a few months his own house was bombed in Birmingham. So it was, not an easy decision to have one of your businesses affiliated with the movement.
Dr. Smith, do you mind going over a little bit beyond 10 just to finish our discussion?
Oh, sure.
Okay, what I'll do is we'll take another break and then we'll continue.
Okay.
National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp, and you are listening to Dr. Suzanne E. Smith, Professor of History in the Department of History and Art History at George Mason University, discussing her book, To Serve the Living, Funeral Directors and the African American Way of Death. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. Dr. Smith, just before we took a break, you were talking about A.G. Gaston. There's another funeral director. I know you profile at least one female funeral director, Clarie Collins Harvey. Would you tell our listeners and chatters something about her life?
Yes, she was one of the most amazing figures in the book. And as you know, you mentioned, it's really important to understand the role of women in African-American funeral service, both as what were called first ladies, women who were married to funeral directors. But in the case of Clarie Collins Harvey, she was the director, a funeral director from Jackson, Mississippi, and she worked in her family-owned Fraser Collins Funeral Home. What's amazing about her story is that her father was one of the founders of the NAACP in Mississippi in the early 20th century, and he risked his life to start an NAACP chapter in, like I said, the 1920s, 30s period. So she was raised in a family that was very much of a kind of activist mode. By the 1950s and 60s, she was one of the leading funeral directors in the African American Funeral Director Association. She was the first woman to be honored as Funeral Director of the Year from the African American Funeral Directors Association. And what happens is she's in Jackson, Mississippi, and she works with Medgar Evers and the people active in Jackson in the early 60s trying to integrate the city. And she gets very involved in the Freedom Riders, the Freedom Rider movement. When the Freedom Riders come through Mississippi, she gets involved in helping support them when they're arrested, making sure that they're taken care of, that they have everything they need with clothing, and involved in that way. So she had, like I said, a real interest in helping the activists who were on the ground trying to make change happen. And also what's significant about her story is that, like I said, she was a very close friend and colleague of Medgar Evers. And when he gets assassinated, she directs his funeral and takes great pride in the fact that she was involved with the funeral, directing it. And when the funeral, Medgar Evers' funeral, as I mentioned a few moments ago, was also very contentious because of the nature of his death, the assassination. And there was a lot of his followers in Jackson who were so angry about his death that a riot almost broke out after the funeral was over, right in front of the funeral home. And the police and certain people involved quelled the riot before it got out of control. But in the book, I discuss that that's another example of how the funeral homes often became actual sites of these conflicts. And I really admired the story of Clarie Collins Harvey and, again, her courage and how she really exemplifies the role of women in Black funeral service.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your book, and I highly recommend it to our listeners and chatters. Sometimes, probably most of us have experienced this, when we took history in high school, it was presented from a broad perspective. What's really nice, what you do in your book, is you march through American history over time, but you give us the viewpoint of funeral directors. And a lot of us, I know I didn't realize how important they were in the African-American community. So we're hearing some of the familiar cases, like Plessy versus Ferguson, but didn't really understand all of the background.
Right.
And I think sometimes the emphasis was on the decision, not how the case got to the Supreme Court.
Right, and who was pushing for the case, yeah.
Exactly. Do you have any other stories you'd like to share or any closing remarks?
I just wanted to mention, I think, in the epilogue of my book, when I talk about the funeral of Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King and how both of those funerals were so powerful in the ways in which I think they kind of reignited some people's interest in the history of the civil rights movement and inspired people and inspired Barack Obama as he was about to get ready to prepare to run for president. And I really enjoyed ending the book with those stories of the way in which the traditions of African-American homegoing in the 21st century continue to have resonances around the ideas of freedom and equality, and that the Rosa Parks funeral in particular, I think, exemplified that.
Would you just elaborate, how did it inspire now President Barack Obama?
Well, he actually spoke at that funeral. As I talk about in the book, Rosa Parks had some could argue, and I kind of argue this, the largest funeral in American history, or the longest funeral in American history, because she had three funerals. She had a funeral in Alabama in Montgomery. She had another funeral in Washington, D.C., and she was laid out in the Capitol Rotunda, and then she had her third funeral in Detroit, and that was at the Detroit funeral, which I believe went over 8 or 9 hours.
Wow.
Where Barack Obama spoke. He eulogized her there. And then, you know, he was a part of the dialogue of that 8 or 9 hour service, which was very political, you know, in its own way. And I think he was, you know, on the radar of people at that time. And then when Coretta Scott King died just a few months later, he was at her funeral in Atlanta. He didn't speak there, but as I mentioned in the book, one of the Kennedys leaned over to him and said, "The torch is being passed to you here at this funeral," which I found is very powerful, this idea that there was this moment of Coretta Scott King dying and that kind of the end of a certain era of the funeral, of this original civil rights movement, and that Barack Obama was sitting there and kind of being anointed within that history as he moved toward running for president. So that was part of what I was talking about there.
Well, once again, let me recommend to everyone your book. It is excellent. It's a delightful read. And Dr. Smith, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's just a thrill to talk to you and share the ideas with your listeners.
Well, let me announce what's coming up next week. You don't want to miss the show on July 18th. The guest will be Dr. Lenny A. Sorensen, a university lecturer, a museum consultant, hands-on presenter, and researcher who will discuss the culinary history of African Americans. Good night, everyone, and remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. You can continue this discussion on Afrogenius.com and research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. Don't forget to listen to the African Roots podcast with Angela Walton Raji on Friday morning. And remember to join Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Harrell on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Thank you once again for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. Good night, and we look forward to you joining the show next week. Good night, Dr. Smith.
Good night. Thank you.